Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Jody Kretzman, and he will be speaking on Signs of Hope in Our Troubled Cities, Session 2. So let's listen in on Jody Kretzman.
My name is Jody Kretzman, and this is the second of a couple of discussions we're having this week about signs of hope in our troubled cities. And the way we started the discussion yesterday was to share a story, which was an ancient story about community from the Sufi Muslim tradition. And it was a story that sort of called us back to thinking about the abundance that is when we look rightly, that is always there in community. And I thought what we'd do to start today is to once again start with a story, an ancient story, but this one out of the Christian tradition. I want to acknowledge a friend of ours and a friend, I think, of Holden Village and of Mary's and John's and other people around here named Parker Palmer for leading me to reread this story with new eyes. But let me read you a story that's going to be awfully familiar and then ask us to think about it a little bit in terms of what it's got to teach us about communities and about cities and about hope. Here's the story. It's from the Gospel of Mark, the 6th chapter. You probably know it. Think about communities and cities as the story gets told again. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a lonely place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. Sounds like cities to me. And they went away in a boat to a lonely place by themselves. And many saw them going and knew them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns, and they got there ahead of them. And as Jesus landed, he saw a great throng, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a lonely place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the country, the villages around and about, and buy themselves something to eat. They're hungry." But Jesus answered his disciples and said, "You give them something to eat." And they said back to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go around and see." And when they found out, they said, five loaves and 2 fish. And then he commanded them all, to sit down by companies upon the green grass. And so they sat down in groups, by hundreds and by fifties and by tens. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And then they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 people. Does this make any sense? What's going on here? I used to think that this was a sort of silly little miracle story that you got told in Sunday school. The spooky stuff came through. You sort of got attached to the fact that you could get zapped anytime, maybe blessed anytime too, and it was pretty random.
That's what I thought too. perhaps it could just mean sharing, just share whatever it is you have, and this may sort of provide a psychological need of sharing this together, and it mm-hmm. fills us spiritually,
You know, there may be a lot of people with a lot of food there that they didn't know about either. You know? The apostles only knew about, but everybody may have been starting to say, hey, wait a minute, let's do this.
Yep.
And you can see the parallel here.
Absolutely.
If you're willing to share a little bit of what you have, others are going to share what they have.
I think that may be right.
Okay, let's go and see. Folktale.
Yes, the Stone Soup folktale, absolutely. Yeah. This is a story, it seems to me, you're absolutely right. This is a story that starts out with the assumption that all of Western capitalist culture is built on. And in fact, the entire discipline of economics is built on. And the assumption is scarcity. What is economics? Economics is the distribution of scarce resources. That's the opening sentence in the Samuelson text, which is still used in all college economics 101 courses. It could be, Michael, the author, it could be that economics is the only academic discipline which is founded on a complete lie. I don't want to go too far. The assumption here is scarcity. 5,000 hungry people and only 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Enter Jesus. He teaches, but then from my point of view, he changes hats and he becomes a community organizer. Right? The disciples come to him and say, we've got a problem here. What shall we do? They've got a solution, you know. Palmer refers to this as possibly the first recorded instance of applied Reaganomics. The answer is, right, that you send them all out into the marketplace, one by one, into the villages and towns, and go and buy your food. Then when you've done that, you come back and have church.
Yeah.
After the market. Jesus says, nuh-uh. Disciples say, they buy. Jesus says, you give. You give. And then Jesus does another thing, which is, I think, indicative of his genius as a community organizer. He sets them down in small groups. Right? Absolutely. Where people can see each other's faces and know each other's names, and begin to touch each other as personal human beings, not the mass. So where he's confronted with the mass and a market defined by scarcity, Jesus builds community face to face. And what's the result? The result is huge numbers of loaves and fishes emerge. Probably you're right, because people had it in their back pocket the whole time. But why give it if you don't know anybody, if you're not part of community, if there aren't the relationships to call forth the gifts don't exist. It's junk you've got in your back pocket. It's not food for community. So I now think that this is a story that is a profoundly moving story about how to rebuild cities and how to build communities wherever we are. And if we were in non-Sufi Muslim style, but instead in Christian Western style, to tag the moral at the end of this story, it would say something like that the road from scarcity to abundance always leads through community. That it's a story about the kind of radical countercultural idea that sits at the center of the gospel. The gospel message is about grace and about abundance, and it's not about scarcity. It's the assumption of economics and the assumption of the society that we live in and the assumption of cities always has to do with scarcity, but that the assumption of community is always about abundance. Does that make sense? It's another way in to the constant rediscovery that we've been making in our odyssey around the United States, from community to community, in very troubled places, in very troubled cities. Let me just recap it briefly. In place after place, from the South Bronx to South Central Los Angeles, with lots of stops in between, as we've been collecting stories from devastated neighborhoods, we've been looking for those stories that are about abundance, that are about successes, that are about the places where people have begun, in sometimes incredibly powerful ways, to rebuild their communities in the absence of a whole lot of outside support. And the hundreds of those stories have led us to a few kinds of conclusions that we've been trying to work on with community folks across the country that we summarized yesterday in terms of a set of images that are about building blocks for community. But the report was that in community after community, folks have recognized that the assumption of scarcity leads nowhere. That in fact, it's an assumption about their own incapacity to accomplish anything, which has led into a kind of dead end. So we played with that assumption of scarcity in this way, by thinking about a kind of mental map to the South Bronx, which contains crime and broken families and unemployment and dropouts and lead poisoning and welfare recipients and on and on and on. And we were suggesting yesterday that this map has determined policy in the United States as it relates to cities for at least the last 30 years. And that the result of that unremitting focus on deficiency has been the erection of a huge, impenetrable set of walls around poor people and poor communities and cities. And that the walls, in a kind of typically American way, were made up of naive, good intentions. Intentions to help and to serve. But intentions which were built on a set of assumptions that somehow had forgotten what it was that community building was about. And so we suggested that the first thing that people who were rebuilding neighborhoods in tough conditions have done is to get rid of that map and to begin to substitute one that they themselves drew, not outsiders, that sort of reconnected with ancient wisdom about communities, and which reminded everybody that every community is always built, first of all, on the gifts of individuals. Individuals conceived of as filled with capacities and resources, not first defined as empty, as deficient, as needy, as problematic. And that the mobilizing kind of mechanism in community building that brought the gifts of individuals into play were the citizens' associations. And that the other kind of powerful tool for community building that lay at the local level were the local institutions when those were recaptured for community building purposes. Now I was trying to do a quick summary of where we were yesterday. Is that about right, those of you who were with us yesterday? What I'd like to do today is to think with you about this map a little bit more. We thought a lot about the other one yesterday and its negative consequences. What I want to think about now is, and then I hope gather some stories from you all, about how it is people are bringing this map to life, how they are, in fact, taking this and beginning to work with it as clay, as building blocks for community. And I want to share a few stories about that and think with you about a few dilemmas and a few challenges, and then open it up for any direction that you want to take it in. Let me start with the gifts of individuals for just a second. You'll notice here that there are some strange subcategories. Youth, elderly, labeled people, artists, income. Let me say a word about why that's as strangely configured as it is. Every community, it seems to us now, we always draw communities as circles. If we have any kind of stuff in our pen, we do. And usually we draw communities in circles for all the obvious reasons, and we often sort of, you know, I won't do much with this probably this morning, but we contrast them to institutions or systems, which are usually sort of more like that. Big, hierarchical, formal, straight-edged. This is a little messier always, these communities, these community things. A little harder to specify what's going on in them all the time. Every community is always built, I was taught by Saul Alinsky, on the leaders. That a good community organizer, Jesus went about looking for his 12, right? And a good community organizer does the same thing. Where are the folks who are plugged in to both the economic and civic life of the community? And how do you begin then to support them, to bring them to the fore, to somehow give them what they need to lead, right? The challenge of leadership development for all of you who work in communities is always there, right? This is important. Everybody needs to do it. And lots of people do good work in this area. Although I think sometimes, footnote, pastors don't do very good work in this area. They could sort of relearn how to find the people who are already leaders, the natural leaders, and lift them up. But we've gotten more and more interested and how it is communities are beginning to think not necessarily about the national leaders, but about folks who are much further out toward the edge of community. Folks on the margins. Pardon my art. People who are on the edge. People who are, in lots of ways, not engaged ever in building community. And when we've started to see communities work with the two assumptions that I mentioned yesterday, we've been particularly interested in those two assumptions as they apply to these marginal folks. And the two assumptions, as you recall, having to do with community building and individuals, is number one, everybody in this community is gifted. Everybody has a gift. And number two, communities are about assuring that those gifts are given. That's what a community does. How does that work with people who are at the margins? Particularly, how does it work with people who are at the margins because they have been sort of captured out of community by institutions? One way to think about this is that there may be a war in some of our communities between community forces and institutional forces over the ownership of individuals. I sometimes think that lots of our institutions, from schools to hospitals to jails, courts, exist because they have been given the power to diagnose deficiency and then to treat it. And the diagnosis and treatment of deficiency is never about community building. It is, in fact, about removing people from community and putting them in the care of outsiders, of professionals, of people who have specialized in the diagnosis and the treatment of the deficiency. some deficiencies aren't people's fault. Most of them, in fact, may not be. In this simple view, for instance, people whose deficiency is basically that they are too young to contribute to the center of community get put in places called schools, where they get filled up until age 18, and then they're ready to come back in and contribute. People who are too old, whose deficiency is their years, get pulled from community, diagnosed, treated, separated. People who are developmentally disabled, people who are coming out of or into prisons, and on and on and on. What all of these folks have in common is that their lives have now been determined by what they don't have, by their deficiencies. And what else they have in common is that they are therefore disconnected, stolen from community. And they are never, ever asked to contribute, to give their gifts back. So we have been particularly interested in the places where community leaders have begun to think about who's on the outskirts, who are the strangers, and how do we reconnect the strangers to the community building challenge based on their gifts. You see the question? Let me just tell you a quick story or two then about how we see that happen in a couple of places. I think the stories should maybe make the point better than these abstract stuff. We've done a lot of work in a neighborhood called Logan Square in Chicago, which is a wonderful neighborhood. You know, Chicago 77, official neighborhoods. It's a neighborhood of about 40,000 people. And it's about now 60% Latino, mostly Puerto Rican, 20% African American, maybe 15% older Eastern European, mostly Polish, and maybe 5% of the others. It's an interesting neighborhood. And in the neighborhood, there's a wonderful 30-year-old now community organization, neighborhood association. It's called the Logan Square Neighborhood Association. And it's been there for 30 years, and it's not one that's grown old and tired. Keeps rejuvenating itself. It does interesting things. It keeps bringing new people in. And matter of fact, what it's wonderful at is finding the natural leaders and bringing them into play. So that's one, you know, it's a group that's done a lot of crime, done a lot of housing, done a lot of economic development, been very involved in the schools. Just a really good neighborhood organization. They came to us about 5 or 6 years ago. We've done a lot of work with them over the last couple decades, really, and said, we need to start thinking again about how we can go deeper into our neighborhood. Because we think that we're doing pretty good at this. We're okay with the most visible folks, the people who float to the top and are plugged in already. But we're not convinced we're doing all we need to do out here at the margins. We think there's a lot of people in this neighborhood that we don't know. And so we started working with them on a little project, and they really put together a fascinating series of events. The first thing they did was to hold a series of 8 meetings around the neighborhood in church basements. And the meetings had one major agenda. And the agenda was to bring ordinary people from the neighborhood together and discuss together who are the strangers in this community. Who are the strangers in this community? Who are the people among us that we just don't know? And they came up with incredibly interesting lists of who the strangers were in the community. Right? They were maybe gang kids, some lists, some older folks who were housed separately. Some people said it was the people who were in treatment for a variety of addictions, because it's the kind of neighborhood it is. Some people said that the strangers in this neighborhood were police. Came in, nobody knew them. But there was one set of folks who was on which was on every list in all of these 8 meetings. And they were people who were living in 3 residential halfway houses in the neighborhood, who had been labeled developmentally disabled, and who were people who had come about 15 years ago out of the big state institutions in Illinois, the industrialization time. And folks said, you know, we know they're there, we know where those houses are, and we sometimes see them walking around the neighborhood, but we don't know their names, we have no idea who they are, nobody I know knows anybody in those houses. If there is the strangest of the strangers, it's those folks. So they decided to work on this question. How would you get to the strangest of the strangers in the Logan Square neighborhood? What they did was they hired a genius to help them work. And the genius's name was Rosita De La Rosa. And Rosita was a high school dropout who had lived in the neighborhood her whole life, a woman in her late 30s at that point, 5 years ago, who had, I would say now, who had two elements to her genes, two major elements, probably lots more. One element was that Rosita is a person who can never look at anybody else without first seeing their gift. Right? I mean, she may never get around to diagnosing what's wrong with me, but first she sees the gift, and she does it with everybody. And her second element of genius was that Rosita knew everybody in the neighborhood, and everybody knew her, and she was connected all over, and people trusted her. So what Rosita did was to start conversations. She went into these homes and began meeting people and getting to know them, and what she was after was their gifts. She was after trying to figure out what these folks had at their core, which could be given to community. And at the same time, she was talking to friends in the community, in businesses, in the local hospital, in the police station, in churches, and sort of preparing the way for some new relationships. Let me tell you a couple quick stories about Rosita Dead. She met a guy who was then a 65-year-old guy named Frank, who was a Polish guy. And nobody had ever heard Frank speak. And he lived in one of these homes. And Rosita introduced herself to him. First visit, spent about half an hour with Frank. Frank was not responsive. Rosita went on and on, told stories, tried to connect, shook hands at the end, said, I'll be back. Went a second time, same thing. No responsiveness at all. Went a third time and started talking for 5 minutes or so, and then all of a sudden Frank took Rosita's hand and they got up and Frank led her back to his room, which was in the back of his house. Rosita was a little uncertain about what was happening here. They went into a dark, windowless room, which was clearly bereft of most of what we would call a homemaking kind of atmosphere. It had one chair and a bed. Frank offered Rosita the chair, sat on the bed. Rosita wondered, well, now what? And she looked around the room looking for some handle. And there wasn't anything there until her eyes lit on the one thing in the room which was clearly the center of life in that room. It was polished, gleamed, it was on a pedestal on top of the dresser, and it was a bowling ball. And so Rosita asked the one question that I now think that no PhD psychologist had ever asked Frank over the years. She said, Frank, you like to bowl? And Frank just lit up. He grinned from ear to ear, got up off the bed, went over, got the bowling ball, gave it to Rosita, and the stroke, took Rosita's hand, placed it in the hole of the bowling ball, was obviously, clearly animated by the presence of the bowling ball. So Rosita knew that she had found Frank's gift. What did she do? She went to her cousin, who was the captain of a team in the Puerto Rican Bowling League, said, "Cousin, I have a new friend who loves to bowl. You have room on your team for another bowler." And he said, "No, you don't.
It's not the same as
you have no."
I know, not. Yeah. He's joined us before.
Yeah. The cousin finally says, "Okay, send him along on Wednesday nights and he can bowl with us. We, you know, he can't be on the team, but we'll let him roll the ball down the So that's what he does. Frank starts showing up on Wednesday nights, and for the first numbers of Wednesday nights, it's clear that Frank hasn't bowled in decades, right? That although he polishes his ball, nothing else has happened. It's all gutter balls, and seemingly hopeless. But then after a few weeks, a few of the balls start staying in the lane, and he actually begins to knock down enough pins to begin to start thinking about getting a handicap, and, you know, sort of getting himself really into the league. And after 6 months, one of the guys on the team, one of the other six guys, Frank is now, so Frank has become the seventh member of the six-member Puerto Rican bowling team. And one of the guys leaves for a job change. And Frank then is invited on, after much discussion, I understand, as the sixth member of the six-member Puerto Rican bowling team. Because in the meantime, what else has happened is that people have begun to invite Frank over to their homes. And he's gotten to know their spouses and their kids, and in fact, has begun to sort of feel a little bit grandfatherly toward the youngsters, right, in those families. And has begun really to begin to establish a kind of relationship. So Frank gets officially on the bowling team. And then after 8 months, a strange thing happened. One night at the bowling league, Frank begins to speak for the first time in anybody's memory. But when he speaks, he does not speak Polish or English, he speaks Spanish, because that's all he's been hearing at the Puerto Rican Bowling League over the last 6 months. So when he comes back to life with language that's Spanish. Right? Well, in the second year, Frank's team actually wins the championship, partly because Frank is getting better at a faster rate than his handicap goes up. I don't know if it meant unfair advantage over the other teams. And in the third year, at the annual banquet of the Puerto Rican Bowling League, Frank is named Bowler of the Year, right? The 68 by now year old Polish guy. And at the same time, what has happened to the Puerto Rican Bowling League is that it has expanded its reach into the community. All of a sudden, the work with Frank has opened up the idea of who we are as a Puerto Rican bowling league. So now people talk about the league as a center of hospitality. And they've run now a Saturday morning bowling league for teenage kids, a lot of them gang kids, and they started out with gang teams, actually, in the bowling league. And they've done a family thing that brings together older folks and younger folks in the community. And they're constantly thinking about projects in the community that the bowling league can do. They have now thought about themselves as the center of community building in Logan Square. How did that happen? It happened because somebody took the time to find a gift in Frank where nobody had ever found one, and connect that gift back into community in a way that the gift could be given. You see, we have whole populations who are never asked to give their gift. Young, old, developmentally disabled. And when the gift is given, they change, but more importantly, the community changes, or as important, the community changes. Rethinks who it is. One more quick story from Logan Square. Rosita also found a younger man named Ed, whose gift was not as hidden as Frank's. Ed was somebody who would go through life grinning from ear to ear, just smiling continuously, talking at the top of his lungs constantly in sentences that would not end and often made no sense, but clapping people on the back, smiling, spreading love, hugging people whenever they would let him, generally being obnoxiously
happy. So Rosita immediately saw what was going on here, and she said, I understand what your gift is, right? This is a happy person I found here. And so she started thinking about her connections in the community, and she went to a high school classmate of hers who was now the head of nursing at the local hospital. And she said, I have a new friend who's really happy, and you work in a really sad place. She said, every time I come over to this hospital, I never see any doctors smiling, no nurses smiling, no staff, no patients. This is a really sad place. Do you have room in your hospital for my friend who's always happy? So the nurse sort of, you know, in a kind of obligatory way, I think probably took her to the hospital administrator. And what they did was they arranged a job for Ed at the hospital. And what now happens is that Ed comes into the hospital every morning and is given one of those big supermarket carts. And the cart is stacked with all of the mail for the 11 different departments in the hospital, for OBGYN and oncology and so on and so forth. And what happens is that Ed delivers the mail from department to department to department, smiling, chatting, hugging people, laughing, and not getting much of the delivery to the right departments.
Because he can't read.
So when it was discovered after a week or two.
It did take a week,
partly because people were adjusting to something new, but also because people, it turned out, didn't mind much. They would, you know, Frank would misdeliver the mail, and then they would get on the phone with each other and say, I've got your mail today, do you have mine? And they'll straighten out. But they did then work on it a little bit, and they invented a color coding system. So now the mail is bundled, and the red dot goes to oncology, which has a red dot above its door now, right? So Ed can have at least a shot at getting it right. I think now, still about 20% of it gets misdelivered. But still nobody cares. We went in about 6 months after Ed started this job to talk to the hospital administrator. We wanted to figure out how he was feeling about this work, and how he felt about Ed being in the hospital. And he was glad to see us, and he sat down, and he said, Jody, let me tell you two things about Ed being here. He said, number one, I've been the hospital administrator at this hospital. This is Norwegian-American Hospital, Chuck. It's, you know, the last Norwegian left this neighborhood 80 years ago, but it's still got the name here, right? He said, every year we have a management retreat in the hospital where the heads of my departments and all the top managers and top docs go off for a day and a half, and we try to solve the hospital's problems and think about where we are as an organization. And he said, every year since I've been there, one of the major agenda items we take at least a half a day every year to solve is the incredible challenge of interdepartmental communication. How you can get these departments to knock down the walls and talk to each other. And he says, since Ed has been misdelivering the mail, that is no longer. He says, everybody in this hospital now knows everybody else. There are much closer relationships than have ever been absent in this hospital. So he said, Ed has solved one of my major managerial headaches. And I should give him credit for that. And he said, Jody, let me tell you one other thing about having Ed in this hospital. He says, I have 265 employees in this hospital. And it is true of only one of them that when he's not here, my phone rings off the hook. People call and say, where's Ed? What's wrong with him? Is there anything we can do? When will he be back? Right? He says, they don't do that when I'm gone. Or any of the doctors, but just for Ed. You see what that's about? I think that's about a person whose gift has been activated in a way which sort of has reactivated the humanity, the community aspect of an institution that ought to be about caring in the first place. Ought to be an expression of community, but had lost it, like so many of our institutions have. Right? And again, nobody ever admitted Ed to that hospital on the basis of the diagnosis, which I think in Ed's case is multiple. He came in to give his gift and was allowed to do that. If that can happen with severely developmentally disabled people, as it has in 50 other cases in Logan Square, where people are in businesses, in churches, in daycare centers, and all are related to families, and you can see them as you walk through the neighborhood, they're no longer like this. And when the Logan Square Neighborhood Association has its annual meeting now, the celebration is about hospitality. It's about who we are as a community here at Logan Square. We are a community that is about everybody contributing. And that's what they say to each other about who we are now. If it can happen with those folks, can't it happen also with gang kids? With folks who we label as homeless? Folks who are fighting a variety of dependencies, been in jail, experiencing welfare, all the reasons that we might have to push folks out toward the edge of community. We've developed a couple of tools to help community builders with community builders to do this kind of work. One is a simple survey tool called a capacity inventory, which is meant to be the opposite of a need survey. In many cases, it's used by local people, particularly in public housing, one place that's been used a lot, to visit each other and to build a knowledge of what it is that people can do, not what their problems are, what it is that people have to contribute, what skills they have, what they've learned not just on the job, but in their life, what they love to do, what they'd like to teach, what they'd like to contribute. When that's the mission, somebody knocks on the door and says, I want to talk to you about what you like to do, the door opens. And in fact, hospitality happens right there. And the relationships become ones of possibility, not ones of shut doors. Okay? So in lots of places, let me just say a couple more things about this. In lots of places, it has become clear to us that the activation of gifts of people who have been labeled deficient is clearly related to rebuilding power in a community. Just talk about the public housing instance for just a second. If I'm just a resident in public housing, I am enmeshed in institutions which define me as deficient. Welfare, health care, just a whole variety, probably criminal justice, a variety of systems, education, that have chewed me up and spit me out continuously. But if, as is happening all over the United States and clearly in Tacoma and Minneapolis and lots of other places, if all of a sudden there's the opportunity for women, particularly in public housing, to say, we could begin to imagine that this place is ours. We could begin to imagine we can manage this place, take it over, even own it one of these days. Then you've got an interesting sort of shift in the power dynamic. And then the questions that become interesting to those folks change. Because if all of a sudden I'm the head of a resident management council, I have the opportunity to run this development, I could care even less than I did before about the file cabinets that line every public housing office in the United States, a welfare office, that are filled with files on every family and their deficiencies and their needs, right? Mm-hmm. How many unwed mothers are there here? Who dropped out of high school? How many folks can't read at what level? Just those were useless to begin with. They're even more useless when people have an idea that they can begin to take some power over their own situation. All of a sudden, resident management councils need to know things like who can paint a hall, who can fix a screen, who can replace a window, who can drive a bus for people who want to find jobs, who can run a daycare center, who has some experience working with older folks. And if you start building a bank of skills and of potential contributors to community building, all of a sudden, if the power shifts a little bit, you've also then got a set of mechanisms for mobilizing those gifts. You see, so this is not just about making somebody feel good, it is about building power for some kind of basic shift in who defines. Who defines? Churches, let me just end on this and then let's talk about this for a little bit. Churches, it seems to me, have a special role here, which could be incredibly exciting. If we can get over what we often face in churches is a sort of inbred need to be needed. Lots of churches are turning the corner, it seems to me. Let me just end with one story. I think now that the sanctuary that makes me happiest when I go into it in the U.S. is a sanctuary in a devastated neighborhood in Detroit. It's the sanctuary of 12th Street Baptist Church. And at 12th Street, a genius of a preacher named Lee Earle did a wonderful thing about 2 years ago. He got his 50 ministers, which, by the way, here's something also that those of us who don't do this ought to learn from our brothers and sisters in the Baptist. I mean, anybody who comes up to a pastor and says, I want to do this, they sort of anoint them and say, well, I should be a minister of that. Do it. Yeah, absolutely. He's got 50 ministers in his church that do a variety of things. You know, everything from worship to liturgy to all kinds of stuff out in the community. But we spent a couple of days with their ministers, thinking with them about community building. And what they decided to do was, each of them, as a starting point, to do 10 what they called gift interviews. To go out to the first of all the members, but then also the close-in residents around 12th Street Baptist. And to interview everybody to find out what the top 5 gifts were that every individual had. Gifts of the heart, gifts of the body, skills that they had, and gifts of the mind. Right, was the way we sort of divided the task. And they came back with huge lists of the gifts then of 500 people because they started with each other. And then they convened the kids in the congregation with a couple of neighborhood artists. And they made 500 colorful banners, one for each person, listing the gifts and symbolizing them. Variety of kinds of colorful themes. And then they hung them up around the sanctuary. So that when you walk into the sanctuary now, you are surrounded by the gifts of the people of this very low-income neighborhood. And there they are. You can see them. And the feeling is that in this holy place, there is nothing that is impossible. On the outside of the streets, things might look pretty tough. But you know, in this church, that the combined and mobilized gifts of the people of 12th Street Baptist Church can turn around everything outside. That, for me, has become an incredibly powerful image for what it is a church could do to be at the center of a kind of community-building enterprise. That then leads 12th Street into all of the stuff that it does. And it's now probably an $8 billion a year operation. Doing housing and economic development, a variety of stuff in the neighborhood, lots of stuff with kids, lots of stuff connecting across generations. And it's all about taking people from the margins and saying, yeah, you have needs out here in the margins. And your major need is to contribute. The major thing you need here is the opportunity to give your gift. I think that's happening all the time. And I think it's really exciting when it does. Let me stop there and see reactions and gather stories and gather, yeah, buts.
Yeah, it seems that most of the stories you've told has required a charismatic leader. It's not really a systemic thing. Maybe it is a little bit, but if you're going to, say, take a housing authority project and try to have it run by the residents, it's not going to happen unless there is that leader. It requires finding that leader, and it's not awfully hard to do if it does require a leader.
I think leadership is awfully important. But I think leadership, I mean, I guess the shorthand answer to that is it's a very interesting question. I think it's absolutely the right question to ask at some point. My experience over 30 years of working in low-income neighborhoods and cities is that it's almost always the case that the problem is there are more leaders there than you can figure out how to use. It's not that there's a lack of leadership, it's that you find continually folks with all kinds of leadership skills, or at least potential, that don't have avenues to express that potential. So leadership is key, but my lesson always is there's always more there than you think, and there's usually more there than anybody can use creatively. So the challenge now is to find some useful ways to make sure that everybody's leadership capacity is mobilized. I mean, that's the way it's come across. Ted, do you have a...
Yeah, I would say, my experience is that it's more systemic than you think. Mm-hmm. And let me give you a real personal example, two of them real quick. One is, we led a series of workshops in Poland on organizing volunteers, and they came back saying, No, we can't do what you do in America. We don't know how to get organized, we don't know how to raise money. And I said, well, why don't you look at it differently? For the last 200 years, you've had one of the best underground systems, okay, in the whole world.
Yes.
It's been well-financed and everything else. Yeah. If you can ever figure out how to run this thing without destroying the government, man, you got something going.
Yeah.
And we now have had three annual workshops on that. The other point I want to make is we have, my wife and I, a 15-year-old handicapped child, a grandchild. And part of the thing that we get involved with is a thing called sibling, what is it? Support groups, okay? And we have gone to a bunch of sibling support groups, and the most consistent thing is that the siblings accuse the parents of underestimating the abilities and the whatever their siblings could be responsible for.
Yeah.
And I think we have basically built into our families and our societies a kind of a point of view or a set of glasses that looks at the negative all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right to point out, I mean, you're right to point out the dimensions of this that are systemic, particularly. I've been spending a lot of time on kind of individual stories here, but the same lesson about abundance, it seems to me, also applies to places like the economy. I mean, it's one thing, we're doing a lot of work right now on a little public housing project with about 850 families on the south side of Chicago, a lot of the sort of capacity inventory, enterprise development, and so on. Everybody looks at this public housing project as the absolute bottom of the economic barrel, and in one way that's true. 90% of the folks in there are on public aid. 10% have work of some kind outside the home or in the mainstream economy. But when we look at that one development from another point of view, what you have is a place that has, on an annual basis, about $7.5 million of income, stated above board income, coming into it every year. $7.5 million. And the problem with that is, of course, that it all goes out, by the way. That it's not captured, that it doesn't circulate, right? That it's not part of the neighborhood economy building process, that it's not captured, that there's no markets there, that there are no stores there, that people don't circulate those dollars. But the minute you start saying what we've got here is we've got $7 million to work with on an annual basis. How do you capture it? That's a different question from saying We've got 800 dependent families here that are all on welfare. Right? It's a very different question. And it's like your underground economy question. I'd love to talk to you some more about that, because we're trying to do some work like that in public housing in the United States, where there are underground economies going on, both legal and illegal, by the way. I mean, some of them are legal. So that's a distinction we have to make. But it's that activity is there, and we might as well both acknowledge it and build on it, rather than ignore it and try to squash it.
I'm just thinking, as you were saying that, looking at people on welfare, particularly single-parent mothers, the fact that they very are surviving on the little that they get, which goes out of their community mostly.
Yeah.
It's a sign that we've got enormous economic skills going on.
That's right.
And organizing skills and all those kind of things.
People can stretch it.
If we could ever just take a look at that, what are you doing to survive?
That's right.
You must be doing something right here instead of doing something wrong.
That's right.
Boy, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
We're not in the habit of it.
Others, does it make sense? Yes.
I was just going to, we have a block from our church, a home for mostly people released from Western State Mental Hospital, although there are others that live there too that have had various addictions or mental health. And they come to the church in all stages of disarray and all different times. Sometimes they just want a cup of coffee. Sometimes they just want to talk. Sometimes they'll go up and want to pray or whatever. But Holly was saying one day he was sitting in his office extremely depressed about many things that you sometimes wish you could change. And Mary, who by every definition of the neighborhood is crazy, and I put that in quotation marks, very often does not speak that we can understand, or comes in and says, God has sent me here to pray for you. Mm-hmm. Completely lucid. Mm. And Holly said, Mary, pray. And Mary prayed in a way that was completely understandable, completely, I just think God did send me.
Absolutely.
And I guess when I think about the gifts of these people, sometimes when you look at Mary and see her tottering down the street talking to herself, you would not expect that gift, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're so caught in that other way of thinking about stuff that it's a constant struggle to bring ourselves out of it and to expect gifts in places where we're not supposed to. It hit me. I mean, I get dumb about this occasionally. It happened in relationship to homelessness to me about 6 months ago. I really hadn't done much work in the sort of homeless advocacy community. But a really wacky philanthropist from Denver, who's H.L. Hunt's daughter, has a foundation there. And she got a hold of some of our stuff and asked me to come out and do some stuff. And one of the things she asked me to do was to meet one afternoon and to talk about community building with two of their major fundee groups. And it's really, it was strange. One group was, she funds community artists, people who work sort of in the grassroots and do art stuff. And the other group of people that she had there was homeless people, who are sort of homeless advocates, but they're homeless themselves, right? So she had this big table in this room, a big long table, and on one side were community artists and on the other side were homeless people. And with virtually no warning, she said, now Jody, I want you to go in there and spend the afternoon with these people talking about community. Thanks a lot, Suwani. So I went in there, was clearly sort of stumbling around. We did a little round of introduction. People in the homelessness introduced themselves, and the artists introduced themselves. And I was sort of stumbling around with some of these themes, trying to find a handle on where to go with this stuff, and really uncomfortable with it. And after about 5 minutes of my stumbling around, somebody on the back of the side of the table, which was the homeless folks, raised his hand and said, he said, I really feel for you, Jody. You're not going to get anywhere at all here in this group. This discussion is going nowhere. Let me tell you why. He said, and he was just absolutely right about it. He said, the reason why this discussion isn't going anyplace is that those people on that side of the table, meaning the artists, all define themselves by what it is they can do. And we defined ourselves by what it is we don't have. And he said, we can't have a discussion because that's about a discrepancy in power that makes discussion impossible, right? And then he suggested a way out. He said, why don't we do another round of introductions? And this time, let's have everybody talk about what they can do, what they like to do, what their skills are. And we did that, and it turns out that the so-called homeless people used to be teachers. Some of them were people who were carpenters, plumbers. Some of, in fact, three of them were people who do art, who were artists in various. So we went around and did the reintroductions. And as soon as that had happened, the rest of the afternoon was just electric. And all kinds of connections got made between the community artists and the people whose temporary condition was homelessness, but not whose definition was the homeless, you see? And the minute their definition got thrown out,